Coded.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. This is the IGO-INGO Protections Policy Development Process Working Group call on Wednesday, 28th of November. On the call today we have Lanre Ayashi, Jim Bickoff, Elizabeth Spinberg, Alan Greenberg, Stefan Hankins, David Hisley, Evan Lebovich, David Mayer, Karen Mellon-Cherville, Osvaldo Novoa, David Opperbeck, Christopher Rassi, Thomas Rickett, Greg Shatton, Claudia McMaster-Tamarit, Brian Peck, David Roach-Turner. We also have apologies from Chuck Gomes, Wolfgang Kleinwachter, Ilya Bazlyankov, Paul Diaz, and Avery Doria. From staff, we have Barry Cobb, Margie Millam, and myself, Julia Chauvelin. I would like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you.
Thank you so much, Julia. Before we dive into the subject, I'd like to ask you whether there are any updates to the statements of interest. Hearing none, I'd like to go to the third item on the agenda, which is the status of the General Counsel request. As you know, during the last call of this group, we have refined the wording of a request for a legal assessment to ICANN's General Counsel, which was submitted shortly after the call. And I've asked staff whether they could follow up with General Counsel as to the status of this request, or at least whether there is a timeline or a deadline until which we can expect a result from General Counsel.
Hi, Thomas. This is Brian Peck from staff. Just to let you know, I did speak with John Jeffrey and his staff yesterday. They are planning to provide a response. They're intending or planning to hopefully do so by the end of this week, and if not by the end of this week, and certainly by early next week. And so that is the latest status I received from them yesterday.
Just to clarify, the response will be a response as to when we can expect results, or will there be substance in this response?
My understanding is that the response will be within the context of providing a response to the question itself.
Okay, well, that's great news. That's great news. Perfect. So I trust that we will have that passed on to the list whenever the response is coming in so that we can use the results for our next call. Great. So I think we're quite quick going through the agenda. The next point on the agenda is the communication to the GNSO from the new GTLD committee. I have passed on the communication, both letters from Jonathan Robinson, the GNSO Council Chair, as well from Shireen Chalabi from the new GTLD committee to our mailing list. In brief, I'd like to report to you that Jonathan Robinson has informed the new GTLD committee with a letter of the 26th of November about the status following the last GNSO council call, and he has reported that the motion regarding second-level protections for certain IOC, RCRC names in the first round of new GTLDs has failed, while the motion regarding the approval of the PDP has passed. He has also informed the new GTLD committee of the fact that this motion will be filed again for the next council call. There has been a request on the 20th of November to propose the motion to the GNSO council again. Now, as a response to that, with his letter of November 27th, which you can see in the Adobe Connect, Shireen Chalabi has reported on the resolutions made by the new GTLD committee. And since I do not want to misrepresent what the new GTLD committee has done, I propose that I just read out those two paragraphs to you. It will not take a lot of your time. Shireen said, I wanted to reach out to you and the GNSO Council to let you know that the committee passed a resolution yesterday acknowledging the GNSO Council's work to date, including the recently initiated expedited PDP on the protection of IGO and INGO names, as well as the resubmitted motion to provide an interim moratorium on the registration of Red Cross and IOC names at the second level of new GTLDs in lieu of the final actions of a PDP. The committee's 26 November 2012 resolution is consistent with its September 13th 2012 resolution and approves temporary restrictions in the first round of new GTLDs for registration of RCRC and ISC names at the second level, which will be in place until such time as a policy is adopted that may require further action on the part of the board. The committee also adopted a second resolution yesterday, which provides interim protection for IGO names from third-party registration at the second level of new GTLDs. The second resolution provides for interim protection of names which qualify for .int registration and for IGOs which request such special protection from ICANN by 28 February 2013. This protection is intended to provide an interim solution similar to the protection of Red Cross and ISC names and the 13 September solution until the PDP work is completed and any permanent policy recommendations are adopted. Both of these resolutions will be posted tomorrow, and the report rationale will be posted next Monday. As you can see, we crafted both these resolutions in a way that recognizes that GNSO work is ongoing. I think I'd leave it at that. You have the full letter in your inbox and in the Adobe Connect at the moment, so you can read it again or read the remaining short paragraphs. Now, I thought it would be worthwhile sharing this with you, since this has quite some impact on our work, because now the moratorium has been adopted in anticipation of the newly filed recommendation or resolution to be passed by the GNSO Council. I have seen one reaction to this by Alan Greenberg on the list, who said that he thinks that now the next GNSO Council vote is obsolete. I'm paraphrasing. I don't have the exact wording at hand. But nonetheless, I would like to hear your instant reactions to this and whether you see any impact on our work with this. I see Ricardo. Ricardo.
Yep. Thanks. Is that Thomas, right?
Yes.
Okay, Thomas. Thanks for the opportunity to speak. Just a very quick question, and I asked this also within the RYSG. I wasn't sure whether this was the case. So this interim recommendation or protection is already valid from, let's say, from today and doesn't require any further approval by the board, by the ICANN board. Am I right, or does it still go through some other process to be finally adopted, just so I understand it better?
No, this is this decision has now been made.
So it applies to all new GTLDs from the moment it is adopted, like with valid from 24 hours or 48 hours from the publication or something like that?
That is my understanding. I have not seen any conditions or other prerequisites in the resolution.
Okay.
Margie.
Hi, this is Margie from staff. My understanding is it's for the first round of new GTLDs, and in the note from Shireen, it says that these IGOs have to request the protection. So it's not all .int names, but the names that qualify under INT and have requested the special protection, if that clarifies your question.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
I'm very much looking forward to reading the report slash rationale, because indeed protections are in general granted with these two resolutions, but we do not know what the scope of that would be and what the organizations would be. So there's no list attached to that at the moment. So that's going to be quite interesting. I have Evan next.
Thomas, it's Alan. My Adobe's frozen, and I'd like to put my hand up, though.
Okay. You'll be next after Evan.
Okay.
Hi. Margie, I just wanted to ask for a little clarification. As I'm reading this sentence here, it's saying that everything that qualifies for .int is subject to the temporary restriction, as well as any other IGO that asks for it by the 28th. That seems to be a little bit different from your interpretation. Could you just clarify? The way I'm reading it is it basically is a bit of a free-for-all. Everything that qualifies for INT is already there, and for anyone else that asks for it that's an IGO by 28th of February. Thanks.
Oh, yes, this is Margie. I'm familiar with the underlying documents. The and is meant to be both. So it looks like the communication from Shireen wasn't that clear, but it's clear in the documents. You'll see when it gets published.
Thank you.
Thank you, Margie. Is there a follow-up question by you, Evan?
No, that's asked and answered. Thank you.
Okay, great. Alan.
Yeah, thank you. It certainly does affect our work because there was still some question in the minds of some people whether we needed to do something for the January 31st. Deadline, and this clearly makes it it makes it clear on several different levels that we do not have to do anything. It's already been done. I'll be candid, though. I'm somewhat perturbed that they use the definition of INT eligibility where I've been told by a number of people that has been a very controversial definition in its own right, and the GAC's proposal of that they would come up with a specific finite list, and that is there, someone is going to make the decision of what qualifies for INT and what does not, would be out of ICANN's hands. And now putting that back into ICANN's hands puts us in the middle of a perhaps small controversy, but nevertheless not the kind of thing I would have wanted to see. somewhat perturbed by that. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Any more comments on that at this stage? So I'd like to add to that, if I may, that Alan, in response to your comment on the deadline at the end of January, I'm not sure whether I agree with this, because I think that the focus is still on the GNSO, to see whether the GNSO is able to react to requests regarding to this subject. And therefore, I think that we are not let off the hook, technically speaking, but I think that we still, you know, although a decision has now been made, we should still be working on this full throttle and show that we can deliver prior to the deadline that you consider moot, but I still think to be relevant in terms of the you know, how the GNSO is being seen. Remember that this subject has been tagged a case study both by the GAC as well as by the ICANN board. I think that you may have put a finger on the sore spot regarding the eligibility criteria for obtaining access to protections, because this might be congruent or incongruent to potential protections that might be recommended granting by this group. So certainly by granting certain protections now, there might be expectations that these protections might be perpetuated regardless of the outcome of our deliberations. I have Ellen next.
Yeah, thank you. Regarding the 31st of January deadline, there's only two GNSO meetings between now and then, and given the requirements for public comment and things like that, I don't see maybe I'm not imagined enough, but I don't see a way that one can fit all the things that would have to happen for a GNSO recommendation to go to the board prior to the 31st. Just the fact of public comments, the fact that decision's going to be deferred by one meeting, I think make that effectively impossible. And I would prefer not to see us trying to make that target, which I don't think could be reached at all. But that's, clearly that's up to you as chair. The overall issue, yes, this group might recommend protections that are less than what the board has done, which would require rolling those back, or of course the board can override. No matter how a PDP is outcome comes out, the board has the right, if there's a two-third majority who feel it would not be in the interest of ICANN, they can override a GNSO recommendation. So, thank you.
Thanks, Alan. And certainly that's a fair point, and I'm not unrealistic to believe that we can get this work done before the end of January. But still, I think that we should use best efforts to work as quickly as we can. And being able to report on substantial progress of our work is better than nothing. So all I'm trying to do is encourage the whole group to be working on this important matter as quickly as we can. Are there more questions regarding this subject? Hearing none, I propose that we move on to the next item, which is the continued exploration of issues defined in the Charter. I have tried to come up with a matrix, or it's not a work plan, but it's actually an aggregation of thoughts prior to this meeting, and I'm sure that not all of you have had the chance to consider or even read this prior to this call. But my feeling was that, and I should make very clear, this is just a proposal. Nothing is carved in stone, so we may completely bin it or change it as we like. But I thought that the questions asked in the Charter are quite difficult to be working on in isolation. At the same time, there is no natural move from one question to the other. That was my very subjective feeling going through the Charter. And so I tried to come up with an idea as to how we can approach this big piece of work and maybe put it in a sort of sequence where we can have smaller bits of work that we can maybe even work on in parallel. So unless there are any objections by you, I would like to introduce my idea to you briefly. So, and while we go through it, you can maybe think of things that you like and those that you don't like. And afterwards, if you follow my suggestion to use this as a rough template for our work, then we can go through the individual items and discuss them one by one. And maybe, and this is a thought that you should also bear in mind when we go through this, we can have or ask volunteers whether they are willing to work on the various areas in parallel so that we can hopefully achieve results in a very expedient fashion. Now, as you can see from the four headings, I have split the work into four different sections. And if you compare those to the items in the Charter, you will see that I was not using the same words, but that we are, at least to my knowledge, able to attribute each and every of the items in the Charter to one or multiple items here. So I think that we will cover everything that we're tasked with or that we have tasked ourselves with these four items. Now, the first of which in A is qualification criteria. And what I mean by that is that we need to answer questions such as, do we want to have or do we wish to consider only one set of qualification criteria for all organizations in question, or do we choose to create different sets of criteria for different types of organization? And should we do so, we should determine which different groups we are going to specify. So the question is one versus multiple types of organizations eligible for potential protections. And this would also cover the point that was discussed earlier in this group, whether or to what extent we should give different treatment to IOC, RCRC, and other groups. I see David's hand up. David, please.
Thank
David,
you. My question is, doesn't this assume that there will be protection? And I don't think we're entitled to make that assumption.
Which is a fair point. I collect your comments first, and then I respond to that. Ricardo's next.
Yeah, just a very quick point, Thomas. First of all, I would suggest perhaps not everyone has had the time to look into this document in detail, myself included, to be honest. So perhaps we could define a certain period of time for people to make comments on this proposed plan of action or whatever you may call it. And just specifically on point A, without prejudice to what David just said, but on the qualification criteria, it is clear that we are talking here about two major categories of organizations. So one category is the intergovernment organization, and they are the level of protection that they enjoy under international treaties is something that is actually just in my view and many other people's views, not even under discussion, shouldn't be under discussion. But anyway, this is one different, totally different category from non-government organizations, which include, of course, the RCRC movement and the IOC, the International Olympic Committee. So it would be impossible to simply say there's going to be only one qualification criteria applicable to all, because we're talking about, if I may say, apples and oranges here. So we just have to be very careful about what kind of legal framework is applicable to what kind of organization. So just
okay.
To make that first point clear. Thanks.
Thank you, Ricardo. I'll take Lanray and Alan now. Greg, if I could ask your patience for a second, because I'd like to briefly run through the points, and maybe that will answer some of the questions. Then we might go back and go to the individual points, and then each and every one of those points will be up for discussion. Lanray, please.
Yes, I'm also of the opinion that we should sequence the discussion appropriately. Just like David said, we probably have to decide whether there is need for protection at all for the IGOs or an INGO before proceeding to determine who is qualified for what protection and all that. So I would prefer a situation where we first discuss whether there is need for additional protection for anyone before proceeding to other items.
Thank you, Lanray. Alan?
I guess my comments are related to the previous ones. I wouldn't worry about David's comment about or Lanray's about deciding about whether we're going to have protections or not. The criteria address that. If the criteria are such that, you know, there no one maps to it, then so be it. You know, clearly, if there were a law against having a top-level domain with a certain name, and there are no laws about that at this point that I know, that would be indicative that we would have no choice. Other than that, it's a much fuzzier question, and I think we do have to investigate what kind of criteria might be used, and one of the possible results, of course, is no one maps to them. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Lanray, is your hand up again or still up?
No, I think it done now.
Okay. Now, to answer David's question, and this was in my little introductory note, which you will find in the email where the agenda was distributed, each and every of those points is certainly depending on whether protections or whether certain criteria should be applied or not. So certainly we can establish criteria, if any, for organizations to that organizations have to meet in order to be able to get protections, but that doesn't imply that these protections will necessarily be in place. As Alan said, it may well be that nobody matches those criteria. But I think the question of one set versus various sets of criteria clustering organizations is a question that we need to ask ourselves, and I understand from Ricardo's response that at least he thinks that we should have different sets of criteria for different types of organizations. Now, going to the next point, we also need to talk about eligibility criteria. Do we take statutory protection as a starting point for this? If so, does it have to be a treaty or national law, protection in multiple jurisdictions? This type of questions or aspects. Or we might use organizations such as the IOC or CRC or other organizations as a benchmark so that only those organizations that meet this benchmark, either if we have just one set, then you would be eligible if you meet that benchmark, or if we had one benchmark per type of organization. There might be additional questions that we can add to this to define potential qualification criteria. Now, the next question, and this is, I'm now going to heading B, is who checks whether an organization that claims to qualify is actually an eligible candidate? So should ICANN do the determination and check against the criteria that we have applied? Should it be a contractor used by ICANN? Should it be an independent third party? Or can we build on an existing list of organizations? So there are various implications with this. There are liability issues if you do a wrong determination, but also there are cost implications to that, so that I think that this is something that we also need to discuss. Again, this list is not exhaustive, but we need to check or have somebody check whether the qualification criteria are met. Then the next big subject is or are protection or protections, and that is that we need to define what types of protections we recommend should be granted. And you might two of the ideas might be familiar with you because I stole them from Avri Doria's email to the list. So we might have just additional designations on a reserved names list. We might also choose to have a modified reserved names list with an exemption process to reflect the potential need of IGOs and INGOs to use certain designations themselves, because if they were quote-unquote merely reserved, nobody could ever use them. Or we could use modified RPMs or completely new RPMs. We might think of utilizing aspects of the trademark clearinghouse, for example, to store data on protections that registries or registrars could get access to. And the last point, and I think this is something that we haven't discussed yet, but which I find at least a point for discussion, is that even though you might be an organization that fulfills the qualification criteria, should there be an automatism that all those organizations fulfilling qualification criteria and pass the eligibility check get access to the protection? To use an analogy, if you are over 18 in Germany and if you have the required health conditions, you would be an eligible candidate for a driver's license. Nonetheless, if you don't pass the test for the driver's license, you are not entitled to drive a car. So we might ask ourselves whether we want to grant these protections per se, whether every organization that thinks fulfills the eligibility requirements gets on the list or gets access to the protections upon application, or if there should be additional criteria, which might be that the organization has faced harm in the past, or whether there were UDRP cases, court decisions, or targeted attacks against that organization. To give you one example, if there was protection for the acronym of the World Health Organization, the term WHO would or might get protected. Nonetheless, it's a generic term, so it may, you know, it might at least be worthwhile discussing whether there should be an automatism or whether additional criteria need to be met in order to get access to these protections. Now, that's my brief run through the areas of work which I think need to be addressed, and I see a comment in the chat. David Marr says, I object to considering these questions before we discuss the overarching question of whether there should be any protections, which is a fair point. However, there might be people in the group, including me, that might want to get a complete picture of the potential consequences of protections prior to discussing whether protections should be granted. So I think it, you know, from a chair perspective, I think it might do no harm to work on the various aspects to get a picture that is as complete as possible. Now, are there any immediate responses to this approach? Ricardo, please go ahead.
Yeah, Thomas, thanks again. I'm not going to get into the substance once more, but simply to request again that perhaps we get a few days to make comments to this proposed working structure, including, as the case may be, David's concerns and so on. But if we could define just a number of days for people in the group to make comments and proposals to this text, I think it would be useful, because it's not very easy to have this kind of detailed discussion right now, considering we just got the paper. Thanks.
Thank you, Ricardo. Greg, you had attempted twice, if I'm not mistaken, to raise your hand and make a comment. Would you like to jump in now?
Yeah, I think, Thomas, I agree with you that we should look at what the consequences are. You know, as we go, I think we will go on kind of two tracks, in a sense, discussing both the issue of whether protections should be granted at all, regardless of the criteria, and what those criteria are, which may convince anybody who's doesn't already have their mind made up that either protections are a good idea or the protections are a bad idea. I think that, you know, regarding them in the abstract, since I'm not of a, I'm not going to say whatever it is I'm for it or whatever it is I'm against it. We have to figure out kind of what we are for and against, at least unless you're an absolutist in one direction or the other. And I would hope that you know, everyone is approaching this with at least an open mind, if regardless of their agenda. Thanks.
Thank you, Greg. I have David next.
I just wanted to make clear that I'm not entirely taking a negative position on this. There are existing rights protection mechanisms, and my position is that the existing rights protection mechanisms are sufficient as protection for these organizations.
Thank you, David. David, I would like to get back to you on this one, because, again, nothing in my overview should carve in stone that protection should be granted. So that's all. I know that it's all interdependent, and I have made this proposal for the sake of speeding things up. So certainly, if we come to the conclusion that no protection should be granted in the first place, then we might have performed redundant work. But I think, or I'm afraid from a chair perspective, that if we do everything sequential, that we will be far too slow.
This is Robin Gross. Can I get in the queue, please?
Yes, you're next.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut off people. I'm not able to get online on the Adobe Connect, so I have to sort of just shout my name out when I want to get in the queue. I apologize.
Sure, please go ahead.
Yes, I wanted to support what David has said about putting the cart before the horse, if you will, and sort of, you know, trying to go through all the criteria of deciding what kinds of protections to grant before we even talk about whether or not we ought to be granting these protections. And I think that he's right, that there are existing protections that are in place, mechanisms that have been put in place to protect these interests. What I don't hear is how are those existing mechanisms insufficient to protect their legitimate interest? We haven't heard that. And so I think that has got to be one of our first conversations. What is it about the existing protection mechanisms that we've put in place that are insufficient to support their interests? Thank you.
Thank you, Robin. Any further comments on this? Okay. Again, and I can't emphasize this enough, this is all this is open to discussion, and nothing is carved in stone. So I'm perfectly happy with starting with the question of whether protection should be granted or not. I felt that it was difficult to make that determination sort of in isolation, but I would propose that we focus on that aspect then first, because I see certain hesitation within the group to take a deeper dive into the various action items that I have written down. I have Margie.
Yes, this is Margie. I just wanted to point out, and I don't know if it would be helpful to the group, but if you take a look at the issue report that was preceded all of the activity in this PDP, it actually does talk about some of the things that Robin asked about. I believe there's a number of submissions from IOC, Red Cross, and UN, OECD that are summarized in the issue report. So just something to keep in mind. And if you would like us to go over that at some point in the PDP process, we'd be happy to do that.
Thank you, Margie. Just taking a quick look at the chat. Okay, I think that part of the reason why we have not included too much information about the need or the reasons for the request for additional protections here is that we have discussed this in the IOC-RC group quite a bit. But I think that we should take a fresh start on that and gather some views on whether protections should be granted or not. And what I am particularly interested in hearing here is some hopefully objective criteria as to how to measure or determine whether additional protections are needed. Because I think that this might help the group make up its mind regarding this question that we could almost take as a zero at the very beginning, you know, the general question, should additional protections be granted or not? I have Liz. Liz, please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Liz Williams speaking. One of the things that is very common in this kind of debate is which gets forgotten is, what's the problem we're trying to resolve?
Say that again, sorry. I have
what, so the issue that we're trying to deal with here is, what is the problem we're trying to resolve? So you reverse out the whether there's a need for special protections at the top level. That first part of that charter piece of work for the group is to I'd like to see a better and more detailed discussion of the problem that needs to be solved that cannot be solved with the protections that are already in place. And I'm not hearing that. Given that I'm not hearing it, then I don't think that, you know, the question of would provide additional protections than that which already exists in international treaties and statutes is relevant. It's just got to be something we have to think very, very clearly about, the impact of if there are mandatory protections at the top and the second level for a very vast array of international organisations, it will become binding contractual policy for new registries to deliver. That is all very well, but I think we have to be extremely careful about the road we're going to go down.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Liz. Sorry, Liz, did you want to add anything?
No, that's okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Liz. I think it would be fruitful for us to obtain some information from the previous work of the IOC-RCRC drafting team. I see that Kieran, for example, is in this call. So, Kieran, I don't want to put you on the spot, but if you want to, you might wish to explain a little bit as to why you deem the existing RPMs insufficient to protect your organization's designations.
Hi, Thomas. This is Kieran. I'm actually going to defer to Jim and to David, who are on the call today. I'm a bit ill, and I'm working from home. So hopefully they'll be able to answer that question better than I could.
Okay. Any volunteers, then?
It's Jim.
Jim, please.
Well, Thomas, as you know, we've spent well over a year discussing IOC and Red Cross needs, and I think that the work that we did in the drafting team, we were able to show the amount of harm that happens on a regular basis to the IOC and to the Red Cross. Through lists of cyber squatters, porno sites, all sorts of misuse of marks on such a huge level. During the games in 2012, we were receiving actually about 1,000 cyber squatting reports a week on things that were obvious cyber squatting sites, and taking down as many as possible on a 24-48-hour basis. But so I think that the harm that was faced was so overwhelming, and that's just in the current 22 top-level domains, that we foresee tremendous damage when you add not just another 22, but possibly, you know, 1,000 or more. And over the long term, it may be a lot more than 1,000 in future rounds. So I think that the work we did illustrates that type of thing, and also illustrates the basis for which the protection was recommended by people like the GAC and the ICANN board and the ICANN General Counsel study. I think all of those should be looked at to confirm that in fact these protections are needed by these groups.
Thank you, Jim. I have Stefan next. Stefan, please.
Yes, hi. Good afternoon, good evening. Yes, I concur. I mean, in the context of the IOC Red Cross Red Crescent group, we discussed this at length, you know, the specificity of the protection, the global public interest which requires to be implemented and enforced, a priori of the eventual violations. I mean, if we take your driving license example, the prohibition to rob a house, for example, exists without having to apply for it, to apply for it with the police. Now, in terms of the damage involved or the prejudice to the organizations concerned, if we take the organizations of the Red Cross, Red Crescent, and we try to document this in several of the written submissions that were made, in terms of in an event like the tsunami in Southeast Asia, we had multiple, attempts of sites being set up, to divert money which was intended for the victims. And we, in the context of the past working group, we consistently made the case that, that the mechanisms existing are costly as such to activate. That we within the Red Cross, Red Crescent, for us to spend donor money, which is intended, to serve victims of the humanitarian crisis in which we work, to address such matters in terms of personnel having to be involved to track down such situations. These are extremely heavy for us to manage. The protection requires to be in place in advance of any abuse or attempts to abuse. And the international treaties which provide for these protections are very clear in this regard. So that's what I will say to this point. There are a number of points that were addressed earlier on, but I will wait, maybe. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Stefan, and I'm sorry for putting you on the spot with this, but I think this is a very relevant question for us to discuss, and looking at the activity in the chat, that's it's great to see so much interaction there. I would like to get your input on what criteria we can use to establish whether protections should be granted or not. So one thing or one idea that I heard from David Maher earlier in this call was to spell out explicitly why the existing RPMs are deemed insufficient. Do we have any other criteria that we could apply for an analysis to answer the question? David, please.
I just wanted to make it clear. I think that the RPMs are sufficient. I don't think there is a question about their insufficiency, although I believe that's a question that this group might want to look at. But my own view is that the RPMs are sufficient.
Thank you, David. Greg.
I would take a position 180 degrees opposite from David and state that, I do believe that the protections are insufficient that the introduction of, 1,000 or more new top-level domains, will make it essentially impossible for organizations such as the ones we're considering to effectively protect both themselves and consumers and the general public without, bankrupting themselves. We're entering a completely different putting aside whether the RPMs are even sufficient in the world that we're in today, in the world we're in tomorrow, I would say they are, completely insufficient. So, thank you.
Thank you, Greg. I might get back to you on that later on, because I think we need to work on that in a little bit more detail as to why we think these RPMs are deemed insufficient or sufficient by by the various individuals on this call. Ricardo, please.
Yeah, no, just to agree 1,000 or 2,000% with Greg's remarks. And to reiterate again that the several arguments have already been presented by the UPU as well as IGOs in general, so I don't want to speak for them. Maybe there's other IGOs on the call to confirm what I just said, but we have already expressed collectively that the current mechanisms are not only insufficient, but they are simply disregarding existing international law and as well as domestic law. So we would caution against any such a discussion in this regard. Of course, we're having a very lively discussion in the chat right now, and this is extremely enriching. But from the perspective of the UPU, from the perspective of, the IGO community, the current mechanisms are absolutely insufficient. And as Greg already said, if we were to oppose applications that somehow use or want to use the name or acronym of an IGO, we would simply have no further budget for any other activity of these organizations. So just to make this point very clear, of course, we're open for discussion and for representing again these arguments, but I just wanted to make this point very clear once more. Thanks.
Thank you, Ricardo. Evan.
Hi there. It's interesting to be both on this call and in the representations that Fadi had over the last couple of weeks over the trademark clearinghouse of all the similarities that exist. And there's a part of me even wondering why these issues have to be handled separately. The complaints that I'm hearing out of the IGO community essentially are the same thing that I hear coming out of Warner Brothers. Frankly, I'm really quite fascinated of the different tracks that these two things have taken. Coming from the point of view of at large, there's definitely a need to protect charities and you know the Red Cross. The Red Cross argument is substantially more compelling than those from the IGOs or from the Olympic Committee, because there is a real fraud purpose. You know, if somebody puts a porn site up and calls it the ILO, nobody mistakes that the porn site has anything to do with labor movements. In the case of somebody putting up a website that says Red Cross Sandy Relief, there is a real genuine public harm. To me, that's the real distinction between here and considering the IOC as or an IGO as just another brand. And I really wish that ICANN would perhaps make a couple of considerations in this regard. Also, personally, I don't see any protections that should be afforded the ICRC that should not be afforded to Médecins Sans Frontières or Oxfam or other groups that have the same issue of public harm that comes from abuse of their charitable efforts on the web. Thanks.
Thank you, Evan. I have Ricardo again.
Yeah, thanks, Thomas. No, it is very interesting to have this discussion, of course, and we have to be careful not to get too excited, because it's something that comes, you know, is very close to heart when we discuss this existing protections or the rights behind any intended protection. And I can only disagree completely with what Ivan said in terms of the so-called non-humanitarian aspect of intergovernment organizations. I mean, this is exactly what we do every day, and it's not just about charity or not just about sending relief, but the scope, the mandate, and the charter of intergovernment organizations is established exactly to ensure the public good. So I would absolutely oppose any such judgment of value which is not based on objective, strictly objective criteria, and the elements that have been already presented by IGOs, the IGO community in general, so far. So this leads me to say once more that we have to make this working group is supposed to make recommendations on the basis of objective parameters, objective criteria, or legally binding statutes, and so on and so forth. I discussed this before. For example, there is no international treaty protection for the name Olympic. I said it clearly on previous occasions, and still this kind of protection went through with ICANN. So, when we simply individualize one or two organizations and we lose the objectivity that these protections are supposed to have, we tend to lead to arbitrary decisions or arbitrary policies, and that's what we're supposed to avoid. So the same for the very long fight that IGOs have been having to have these rights recognized by ICANN, because this is simply so clear in our minds that we were really at a loss as to how to explain to them why these rights were so clear. So, again, I'm sorry for the slight rant, but just to emphasize a few important points to the group. Thanks.
This
Thank
is
you,
Robin Gross. Can I get in the queue?
Who's that?
This is Robin Gross. Can I get in the queue?
Sure. I have Greg first, and then it's your turn, Robin. Greg, please.
Hi, it's Greg Shatton. I think I do want to agree with, in part, with what Evan was saying with the last part, which is that, and I think the very reason for this working group, which is, you know, beyond the IOC and RCRC organizations specifically, that there are many other organizations such as Médecins Sans Frontières that you know are worthy of similar protections, and the very idea of this working group is to establish criteria that would give due consideration or opportunity for those organizations to get the same protections and not have to run around ex post facto knocking down houses that others have built that infringe the on their rights and their names. I think that where we do differ, I think, is where Ricardo was stating that looking at content of the sites, I think gets us off into a down the rabbit hole. And I think that while the ILO is rather obscure, well, maybe not obscure, but not as easily recognizable acronym as some other acronyms our names may be, but that in general, where organizations that are not affiliated with an IGO or INGO are picking a domain name in order to drive traffic because people will click on it because they think it relates to that organization's work, and that is a harm in and of itself before you even get to the issue of content. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Robin, please.
Thank you. Yes, I'd like to support what David had said previously, that I believe that the existing protection mechanisms that we've created are sufficient to protect these interests. And so I think it is really important that we focus on what those are, and if they do not protect these interests, I'd like to hear more about how and in what way. Unfortunately, all we hear when we try to press on this point is sort of grand statements with no detail. Fear-mongering, oh, this is going to bankrupt us, hand-waving about treaties. It's just, we need to hear specifics, details about how specifically do these RPMs leave someone unprotected. In what way specifically? I think we need to go back to a point that Liz made earlier. What is the problem that we're trying to solve here? Because sometimes I feel like this discussion comes around to a referendum on whether or not we like these organizations, whether or not we think the Red Cross and the Olympic Committee do good work. And that's not what the substance of this discussion is. This isn't about whether or not we like charities, whether or not we like these organizations, but in what way are their legitimate interests being unprotected here? And I think we need to hear specifics and not just sort of grand statements of, oh, what's this going to bankrupt us, fear-mongering sorts of attacks. I think we need to hear more specifics. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin. Greg, is your hand up again or still up?
I'm taking it down. That was an old hand.
Not to worry.
not to worry. I have carefully listened to all the statements that have been made and read the comments in the chat, and as was previously said, we heard a lot of strong words like David plus 100. You know, usually it's plus one, but now it's plus 100. Or I disagree 180 degree, or I support 1,000 or 100%. So it's very biased. And I have asked at the very beginning whether we have objective criteria that we can discuss, because I think it's very true that this is not a discussion of whether we like or do not like certain organizations or their missions. My role as a chair is try to facilitate discussion accurately reflecting all the pros and cons, and then being able to convincingly provide reasons for why this group came up with one or the other decision. So I would like to remind us all of the fact that we need to look at objective criteria. These can be laws or liability risks for registries and registrars. This sort of goes in line with the question that that has been put to General Counsel. But also, we need to discuss, I think, that we are talking about protections at the top level. We're talking about protections at the second level. What are the differences of these potential protections or scenarios? We're talking about identical strings. We're talking about combined strings or similar strings, because from what I recall from the IOC and RC discussion, there were quite some, or there was quite a number of abuse cases taking place in, under domain names where the designation has been combined with another term, or where a variation of the term has been used. And also, what complicates our work is that we can only derive findings from experiences in currently existing TLDs and with existing RPMs, but it's hard to predict the future for the new RPMs. So I let this conversation continue because I wanted to give everybody the opportunity to voice their concerns and their positions. Maybe as a next step, we can slice the existing RPMs and the threat scenarios to get to more objective parameters, one of which we heard that is cost or resources. Are there more? I also heard the question, what is the difference, or what is the difference in threat for a trademark holder versus an organization that derives its protection from a treaty? That's a point that Evan made, comparing the discussions here to those surrounding the Trademark Clearinghouse. So are there any views or suggestions in terms of what criteria to apply, or would representatives of IOC, RC, or other IGOs be able to further specify where they see deficiencies in the currently existing and proposed RPMs? Greg, please.
Oh, yes. To touch on a few points on the second question of insufficiency, you know, if we look, you know, first, most of the, if not all of the protections that are available are only for identical strings without the addition of other words. So Red Cross Sandy Relief is almost certainly not a registered trademark, since Sandy only occurred a month ago or less. So while Red Cross, you know, may be protected, Red Cross Sandy Relief is not, and therefore many of the existing protections, you know, wouldn't be available to that, if any. The Trademark Clearinghouse, similarly, some of these may or may not be, registered marks, and their, issues may be somewhat different from trademarks, but if we view them as marks, the Trademark Clearinghouse is supposed to disappear rapidly. It's a house that's being built kind of like for a World's Fair that's going to be knocked down as soon as the fair is over and not used permanently, unless, some of the discussions that are happening with Fadi change that. So that's, does not provide any kind of long-term, resolution of the issues. Further, without trying to use florid language, I think I, just can't underscore how much cost, especially for organizations that are, in many cases maybe, smaller and not, well-funded, can be an issue, especially, those in maybe developing, represent more developing nations and the like. So, I think, we can obviously, plunge into this in more depth, kind of, talking about this off the top of my head. But I think that there, we run through them, and there are, many resources, available that we can, bring to these calls of, that discuss, the insufficiency of these. I'm probably assuming that, many of them have been seen by those who are saying they are sufficient, and, there may just not be, I hope that we will have a, continue to discuss. I'm just not sure that anybody is going to convince the other side on this point, kind of a red state, blue state sort of issue, at least, sorry to make a reference to American politics, but I'm not sure that anybody is, convincing anybody of anything in Washington. Maybe we can do better. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Any further comments, or may I specifically ask representatives of the IOC and RC maybe to share some thoughts on the deficiencies or potential deficiencies of existing RPMs or future RPMs for the situation?
Thomas, it's Jim Bykoff. I think Greg really summed it up. The protection is very limited. And I think for our organizations, it takes away from a lot of the funding that we're doing for the Olympism, which is the benefiting humanity through sports. We've sent materials to the IOC RC drafting team, the past drafting team, showing the types of work that's done with funding for education and medicine and things of that type. We can recirculate those materials to the new group. Maybe that's something we should do. But this is all ground that's been covered, and I think for the new people in this PDP, some of these materials probably should be recirculated.
Thank you, Jim. Ricardo.
Well, I just would mirror those comments to say that the IGOs have presented also over the past 1 or 2 years, communications with the same kinds of arguments have just been said. So this could also be recirculated as necessary. Thanks.
Ricardo, I have one question for you, or maybe Jim wants to answer it. The question was posed earlier, and what way do the concerned organizations consider their situation to be different from that of trademark holders that are also envisaging harm or the risk of their designations or variations thereof being registered and abused by third parties?
Well, I can say for the IOC that what's protected under the multiple national statutes are words and not brands, so that the words are prohibited from use, not the brand names. They're not trademark protections.
Well, from the side of the UPU, I can simply say there are specific international treaties as well as domestic provisions, and they have been exhaustively communicated to ICANN over the past years that simply state that the non-registrability of those names and acronyms in national jurisdictions. So actually the protection enjoyed by IGOs in general, and this is defined under Article 6 ter of the Paris Convention, it goes way beyond simple considerations of a domestic nature, for example. So it's not even something that is subject. If you wanted to register something like that, you would not be able to. So the specific considerations have already been made by the IGOs, and we could recirculate this with the group once more. And this is exactly why this community of organizations has been stressing so much this point to observe international and as well as domestic law. So if the group so wishes, we can, of course, make those available once more. Thanks.
I mean, it's just a question of if you want that done, we can do it between now and the next meeting.
I think that would be helpful because these questions pop up now, and only a subset of the participants of this call have been present when the discussions took place in the IOCRC drafting team. I have David Maher now.
I have no objection to recirculating the materials, but the point, I believe, is that registrability of a trademark is a vastly different concept than registration of a domain name, and that's why we have this PDP going on.
Well, and David, what would your suggestion be in terms of criteria to apply to answer the question?
As I've said, I think I don't see a need to get to that because I don't believe that there is any need for the protection that we're talking about. I think the RPMs are sufficient protection.
Okay, thank you. I have David Roach Turner next.
Thanks very much, Thomas. I'd just like to add my support to the comments made by Ricardo a little bit earlier there. I mean, I think it is important and valuable to recall, as Ricardo did, that there are bases in international law under treaties. Ricardo referred to one in particular, 6ter of the Paris Convention, that provides specific protection for the names and abbreviations of IGOs. And that these organisations that have those names and abbreviations protected under that particular treaty and in domestic law as well, of course, operate on the basis of public funds. And those public funds ultimately need to be pumped into any of the existing RPMs that are curative. They require payment of monies in order to make them work. And particularly in the context of a vastly expanded domain name system, one of the things that IGOs, I think, are concerned about is the direction of what effectively are public funds into this need for curative enforcement, which is why there has been this discussion, I think, ongoing for some time about the need for a different form of protection, which is preventative in nature rather than curative, and which doesn't come at that cost ultimately to the public purse.
Thank you very much. Greg?
Thank you. I think, you know, first, you know, going back to David Maher's statements, I think, and to Jim's as well, the point here is that we're not dealing with trademarks. I hesitate to say mere trademarks, but trademarks, we're dealing with, you know, somewhat of a different animal, you know, because of the what has been identified in our charter and even in the previous discussions, that these are names that are protected by statute and or treaty that you know have absolute protection under those treaties or at least different protection. We're not talking about commercial brands in that sense, in the same sense, so that we are talking about something that is a different animal, at least a different breed of animal than trademarks, which are established only by registering on one or multiple national trademark registries. Rather, these are names that have been protected by a specific you know treaty and or law, and that's really where this discussion differs from the discussions that are happening with regard to brands. I think we can't we shouldn't muddle the two, because the very basis of this PDP is that there is a difference. Whether that difference drives additional protections is the essence of what we're discussing here. But there is a difference, and I guess, you know, I would also ask David or others on the call why they believe, and how, you know, more specifically they believe that the current RPMs are sufficient. I haven't heard any discussion of that. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Before I give the floor to Stefan and David, I'd like those of you who want to speak up to add them to the queue, because I would like to close it afterwards to move to the next agenda item. Stefan, please.
Yes, thank you. Stefan Hankins, ICRC. Well, I want to concur with much that has been said, in fact. First of all, as I already mentioned, we have already highlighted and sought to document to some degree, or as much as we could in the papers we submitted, the actual prejudice that misuse of the names of the registration of these names and the setup of sites causes. But I'm afraid I have to come back to a point that I have made many times in the past working group, which is to highlight that the designations of the Red Cross, Red Crescent, Red Crystal, in fact, are in some way they're a case of their own, because the global public interest does not flow, at least it doesn't flow primarily from their affiliation to any organization, whether to the International Red Cross, Red Crescent movement, or any of its components. They're protected as designations of the protective emblems of armed forces, medical services, and organizations caring for victims of war that are duly entitled under domestic legislation to display these emblems. They're not protected because they're the emblems of the ICRC or the Federation or the American Red Cross. It's a different thing. The global public interest, which is recognized also in the GAC's communication to the board, also reflects that aspect. They're not protected because of our names. That is only a secondary reason for their protection. So I think we have to have that in mind, and I think from that really does stem the need to distinguish and maybe in this instance to have a sui generis look at the issue, because we feel that, you know, the protection of the designations doesn't fully fit within the purview of the PDP as it is set. I mean, there is no organization actually called Red Cross. There is an organization called the International Committee of the Red Cross, International Federation of Red Cross, Red Crescent, American Red Cross, French Red Cross, but there is no organization called Red Cross. While these designations are also protected under international law, universally ratified treaties as such. So I think this is important. I also want to reiterate the points that we've made. These are not protected as trademarks. They are protected under international law under a different reasoning. It's a different question. So I do want to make this point. I think it's important that we have that very clearly in mind, so that we don't confuse matters. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Stefan. David.
Yes, thanks. I just wanted to respond briefly to Greg. That I think that the position of the IGOs in this PDP argues too much. The concept that these existing treaties, and I'm not denying the existence of the treaties, but my point is that they have nothing to do with domain names. And the same principle really applies to trademarks. And I think there are differences, admittedly, but the arguments that are being made lump them together, and that's part of the problem of getting some resolution of the work of this PDP.
David, I have one follow-up question to you, if I may. You say that there are differences between domain registrations versus trademarks versus designations of the of IOC and RC, or treaty-protected designations. But if my recollection is correct, then not all of the planned new RPMs can be used by IGOs, since they are explicitly designed to help to avoid or fight trademark infringements.
Well, that's true, and I can understand the desire to deal with organizations like the Red Cross or some of the other charitable organizations as having a separate status based entirely on what you might call humanitarian grounds. I don't think, though, that organizations that are strictly intergovernmental deserve the same kind of consideration as, for example, the Red Cross.
But you said earlier that you deem the planned new RPM sufficient. Would you still open them up for designations of the of IOC, RC, RC, and other IGOs?
Well, I think the Red Cross and the Olympic Committee, which are the two that are the subject of the proceeding before the GNSO Council, ought to be treated separately. I mean, that's a separate issue.
Okay, thank you. I have Evan next.
Hi. Just wanted to make a couple of points. First of all, just to agree with the previous conversation that they should be addressed separately. Again, that's a different issue, but I would fully agree with that. Also, on the issues that I was trying to make previously, where I sort of raised what seems to be a bit of a Pandora's box about comparing this to trademarks. Of course, the international treaties and trademarks are not identical, but the end result that is being requested is functionally almost identical. In the Trademark Clearinghouse, there's a very controversial move about the idea of blocking domains. That is, you know, what is being asked here, so that things are reserved, so that you don't even have to bother doing defensive registrations because they're already being blocked. That exact same tactic is now the source of significant conversation over the Trademark Clearinghouse discussions. So while the reasons for the blocking and the reasons for the claims issues may be coming from very different sources, what I'm trying to get at here is that functionally within ICANN, the end result is the same. That is, the domain is not available for use by somebody that might want to use it, possibly for an illegal or fraudulent purpose, but also possibly for a totally legitimate one. And so I think what we need to do is find out the nexus of that with this so that we're not totally reinventing the wheel. And finally, although there's been made reference to the global public interest as expressed from the GAC, I would also want to remind the callers here that ICANN does have an at-large advisory committee that is explicitly charged with protecting and advocating the global public interest. And let me tell you, our views are absolutely not totally in sync with the GAC on this. Thank you.
Thank you, Evan. Greg.
I guess I would just say that, you know, the argument that brands are not the same as domain names, while they're obviously a brand and a domain name are not exactly the same thing, that the use of brands or the use of strings or words or terms or names in domain names, you know, is, you know, performs a function of identification, you know, just like a brand or a name does. If I go to gregshatton.com, I expect to find something about me, or rather somebody else might expect to find something about me, and if they find a porno site or a get-rich-quick scheme, they might either associate that with me or at the very least they've gone to that site because they're trying to find something about me. And I think that if we were to take the argument that brands have or names of IGOs and NGOs have nothing to do with domain names, that would argue that there should be no RPMs whatsoever at all. Maybe that's the implicit position of those who are arguing, at least some who are arguing that the RPMs are sufficient. You know, what they're really saying is that the RPMs shouldn't exist in the first place, but that horse has left the barn. I would submit that the issue of whether there's a relationship between, you know, words and domain names and is another horse that has left the barn. The issue that, you know, we're dealing with here, and, you know, I don't think we should, you know, be discussing the issue of you know, brands per se on this call. That's really because I think the difference between IGO and INGO names and the way that they are protected and established is really a difference with a distinction, and is really, again, the subject of this particular PDP, and, you know, that getting dragged off into the weeds on trademarks, while it might be interesting and fruitful, I think it would be interesting, it would be fruitless, and also, more importantly, it's outside the scope of this PDP, and I think we do need to focus on that. And I guess, you know, the last thing I would say is that while the IOC and RCRC have been very focused on, you know, moving these protections forward for their own organizations and at least implicitly for other organizations, I think that we can't stop only with those organizations, you know, and you know, while they, you know, it's great that they've kept their eye on the ball, other organizations, you know, OECD for, you know, one of a thousand other examples, you know, shouldn't be penalized if, in fact, there are you know, appropriate reasons that they should receive protections. And that's, you know, the reason why we're trying to engage in a policy process here. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Ricardo.
Hi, Thomas. Thanks again. I'm going to be very quick. Just to reinforce one thing that I said a moment ago in response to whether IGOs would be less or more humanitarian. This is a very slippery slope to take. We should not be making, in this working group, judgments of value on whether a certain organization is nicer than another. So all IGOs, by definition, they serve a common public good, a common public interest. That's why the member states, they come up, they get together, and they form these organizations. So to say now that perhaps the UPU, when rebuilding the whole postal sector of a country devastated by natural conflict, is not as good as some other organization, or perhaps the Olympic Committee because they're doing some sport activities, I'm sorry, I don't think this is really a discussion that should take place in this group. We have to stick to objective criteria, to international and domestic law as applicable statutes, so that these are fully taken into account in any kind of ICANN policy as determined by its bylaws. Thanks.
Thank you, Ricardo. Ellen.
Thank you. The conversation or the points made by David and you, I think, are something that we need to note for future reference. Should we decide that indeed new protection mechanisms for some of these names are not necessary, or maybe even if we say they are, we need to include in part of our recommendations insurance that these organizations are treated reasonably. I'll remind you that more years ago than many of us can remember, the IGOs did come to ICANN and say, we want something comparable to the UDRP so that we can actually take action against people who may be misusing our name. And after a lot of study and work, the decision was made to say, let's wait till after the new GTLDs, and that will cover it. Well, it didn't. There is still no UDRP. The URS does address them, but not the UDRP. And we need to make sure by the time we finish,
if something needs to be done in that direction, we may not be able to do it according to our charter, but we can certainly recommend that it be taken up. And, you know, we need to make sure that the organizations we're looking at have reasonable protection, whether that's blocking complete, you know, reservation or nothing more than reasonable rights protection mechanisms. We need to make sure that we have a consistent, solid picture so we're not doing this again 7 years from now. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you, everybody, for your valuable contributions. I will try to amalgamate that into an info paper for the group to continue its discussion on the mailing list. Before I move to the next agenda item, or we move to the next agenda item, I was wondering whether you would find it valuable to obtain some information about the history of this and similar protections. And therefore, Alan, thank you so much for reminding the group. But, you know, today Chuck Gomes has sent in an apology. He's not there, but he has been the chair, if I'm not mistaken, of the Reserve Names Working Group a couple of years back. So unless I hear objections from you, I would invite Chuck to provide us with some information on their work a couple of years back, so we better understand their deliberation when it came to reserving and thereby protecting certain names. I would like to encourage the representatives of the organizations seeking protection in this group to resubmit their papers and evidence, information on why they think protection should be granted. Certainly, a lot of points have been mentioned during this call, but you have referenced certain papers that have been circulated earlier on, and I think it would be valuable to have them circulated on this mailing list. I would like ICANN staff to at least send links to the previous work done regarding IOC and RC, the preliminary report and the final report has been mentioned earlier on, and maybe we can ask, I think, if I'm not mistaken, Brian was the primary drafter of that document. Margie, is that correct?
Yes.
So maybe we can ask Brian to show us through the document so that we're all on the same level of knowledge regarding this previous work. Also, those who have opposed to granting protections, I would like to encourage to send objective criteria as to why protection should not be granted to the list so that we can so that we have all information that we need to continue our deliberations by the next meeting, hopefully. I would, being cognizant of time, we have 25 minutes left. I would like us to go through the paper as edited by Ricardo, seeking input from the SOAC and other groups briefly. I'm not sure what is, whether we should go through it sentence by sentence or whether I should just generally ask whether you have any objections to the edits made by Ricardo. So maybe you can have a quick look at what's on the Adobe now, so that we can run through the document and hopefully come up with an agreed version that can be circulated.
Thomas, this is Barry. Just real quick to advise the working group. Essentially, there's two requests that are going out. One is specifically within the GNSO, which is what we're looking at here, that would be sent to stakeholder group and constituency chairs. And then the second request for input is from at the SO and AC level. Essentially, the introductory statements in between the two are kind of different because they're catering to different audiences. but the substance of where we get down past the process and more into the questions to consider is both the same across both documents. So I think if we get into the substance of the SGC one that we have now, then that can just be cut and pasted over into the SOAC request.
Thank you, Barry. That's most helpful. I was cutting this short, but as you might remember from Ricardo's email, he was making exactly that suggestion that his edits should be transferred or copied and pasted to the other document. So can I hear your comments on this paper and whether you have any objections to the edits that have been made? David, please. David, maybe you're on mute.
The reference to INGO is not complete. INGO is defined as only a small subset of NGOs, and I think that should be made clearer. Also, I have not had a chance to review these changes, and I would like to be able to review them and make comments on our website, on the email.
Okay. Point taken. Do you have a suggestion in terms of wording for the INGO issue that you flagged?
It should be picked up from the issue report, where I think it's spelled out clearly.
Okay, so maybe staff can fix that. Ricardo.
Yeah, thanks, Thomas. Thanks for putting this on the screen as well. No, just to clarify to David, the use of the acronym INGO here is simply replicating what is already being used in the charter of the working group. So it seems like, as I understand it, the mandate for this working group is simply to study protections for IGOs as well as INGOs. And within this category of INGOs, of course, you have the Red Cross, Red Crescent movement, and the IOC. So that was simply the purpose. But I would agree to maybe, Thomas, perhaps this could be relayed to the group. I mean, I already sent it to the whole group, but perhaps people could have maybe 1 or 2 days to make comments, because they may still need some time to go through that. Thanks.
Yeah. Sorry for being unclear with this. Certainly, the document will go to the group, and we will give the whole group the opportunity to comment on it. I was I intended to get all comments that this group might have, you know, the representatives on the call, to at least get preliminary feedback and the points raised here incorporated into the draft that's going to be circulated to the group. So are there any further requests for amendments?
Excuse me, Stefan Hankins speaking. Yes, building on what my previous comment, once again, the names that are associated to the organizations which are named here, Red Cross, Red Crescent, those designations are not protected as the names of organizations. So, with the amendment, develop specific recommendations for appropriate special protections for the names and acronyms. I'm sorry, I'm not on the right page now. For IGO and INGO names, including Red Cross and IOC, this does not reflect, what needs to be looked at, because the names are not protected primarily as that. So, this to us is not simply an issue of being distinguished from the NGO-INGO categories. It's an issue of substance for the group to consider. Thank you.
Thank you. Stefan, would you be able to submit an amended wording that reflects your view to the list?
Yes, we'll do that. I need to review the whole because there are different moments where changes have been brought. So we can submit a proposal. Yes, we shall do that.
It would be greatly appreciated if you could do that as soon as possible. I have David next.
Thomas, could you put me in the queue after David?
Sure.
Thanks, Thomas. Just a quick observation, I suppose. I haven't had a chance to go through the document in detail yet, but I will do that, and I think it makes sense to have a brief period of time for that to occur. I just have a question, which is that the discussion that we had at the very earliest part of this call, which was very useful, about the impact that the that has gone now to the GNSO Council, concerning, among other things, the question of interim protection based on INT registration criteria, whether a reference to this letter and its potential impact on the present deliberations might also be usefully reflected in this document for something as something for the group to consider further as more particulars and information about the implications of that letter become clearer.
Yes, good point. Maybe Marjorie or Barry, maybe you can include an additional sentence or a short paragraph to reference to that latest communication, if that's possible.
Hi, Thomas. This is Barry. Yes, I think that's a good idea. In fact, we may want to even wait once the resolution has actually been posted so that we can include the link in there and any details that might be associated with that. So hopefully that'll be up in the next day or two as well.
Wasn't that planned to be publicized on Monday? Monday would be a little bit late, in my view.
Okay. Well, I'll add the few sentences, and certainly I imagine it'll take us at least a week or so to finalize this draft before we send it out, and then we can include the resolution in it as well.
Okay. Now, I have a question to the group, which is, the questions to consider, which you find in the request for input on the second page, they basically cover all the aspects that are in the charter. We have seen today that there was a very vivid discussion surrounding the very fundamental and general question about whether to grant protections at all or not. And it was my understanding that at least by a subset of the participants today, this was seen as a condition for further work or a question that needs to be answered first. Would it be something this group would like to see that we include something on that in this call for input? And I've seen that David has asked in the chat, how can you prove a negative? I guess that was in response to my encouragement to those opposing to special protections that they should provide input. Certainly you can't prove a negative, but I would like to encourage everybody who is imposing as well as those who are in favor of additional protections to share their views with us and to sort of make them as objective as possible based on past experience or other criteria. I have Ricardo now.
Yeah, thanks, Thomas. Perhaps in reply to your request, isn't that covered already by the on the first page of the proposed draft? You have already a sentence saying, as part of its deliberations on the first issue, as to whether there is a need, etc. And then on the second page, the first question would exactly be what kind of entities should be considered for special protections. So, of course, if the views of a certain group are that none should be, organization or no specific name should receive this kind of protection, they would just put the answer there. And then everything else would fall from there. So I would just wonder whether this is already being covered by the paper. So there would be no need for a specific editing. Thanks.
Thank you, Ricardo. This is sort of a variation of the discussion that we had surrounding the wording in the charter, where you also said that, you know, we're sort of prescribing an outcome of the PDP. So my intention with this question is not to drive it into one or the other direction, but just to accurately reflect what information we would like to seek. So, you know, one might say here that what kinds of entities, comma, if any, comma, to make that clear. But, you know, that's up for, you know, for your comments. Greg, please.
I was just going to say briefly that you can prove a negative, and, you know, the statement that you can't prove a negative is kind of a convenient bottle stopper in a conversation, but it's just not true. We don't need to go off into philosophical and logical weeds on that point, but it's, you know, let's just get beyond that. It's a pretty silly statement, actually, if you delve into it, which I don't think we should do, but we should delve into, you know, the issues and, you know, supports for all the positions on the call. Thanks.
Thank you, Greg. Back to my question. Do you, and I'm going to phrase that more clearly in a second, do you consider the scope of question one sufficiently clear to get the results that you would like to see as the basis for our work? Or would you like to see an edit along the lines of what kinds of entities, comma, if any, comma? So those who are who would like to see an edit on question one, please make yourself heard now. Otherwise, we're at least going to leave the wording as it is for the time being, which certainly doesn't preclude you from making any comments on the mailing list later. I have David, please.
I support adding, if any.
Okay. Any further comments on that? Who's that?
This is Robin Gross. I agree.
Robin, please. Yeah, okay. So you agree?
Yes. With David.
So, Barry or Moji, can I ask you to put this into the small edit into the draft prior to it being circulated to the group? And then certainly it's up for discussion with the group. But I just, you know, want to make sure that we have amalgamated our wishes in terms of feedback into this document. In terms of point six on the agenda, which is the review of the work plan, I would very much like to skip that for the time being, since I guess it makes sense to revisit that once we know what route we're pursuing in terms of work. You know, I had proposed to split our work into various sections, and we're going to shelf this for the time being. But, you know, once we have a clearer picture on where we're moving, I would very much like to add milestones or even deliverables to certain milestones so that we can more easily monitor the progress of this working group and report on it. In terms of next steps and next meeting, I think the next step for us is to gather the information that we mentioned earlier for the group. Also, we should discuss the request for input, the two documents that that Barry referred to. Barry and Margie and Julia, what do you think would be what time frame for that?
This is Barry. I should have that out to the list no later than tomorrow morning.
Okay. Given your staff retreat, I was asking, but that's great information. And do you, you know, this goes out to all the participants of the group. Do you think it would be sufficient if this went out tomorrow for you to provide feedback by Monday, so that we can have more discussion and adopt an agreed version without too much work on the call next week? You know, to get it finalized. You know, I would very much like to see that we
finalize this document based on the discussion on the mailing list and not take too much time of next week's call. Any oppositions to that? Hearing none, I would seek your feedback on the document by Monday, and then we would circulate an updated draft incorporating your feedback Tuesday morning, the latest, so that we have hopefully something that we can adopt on Wednesday during our next call. Barry, what is the exact time for the next call? Or Julia, I don't know who of you has taken care of that.
Hi, this is Barry. Next week, it'll be the same date, but it'll be at our original time, which was 1900 UTC. And we should get the calendar invites or the notices sent out in the next day or so as well.
Okay, great. So unless there are unless there's opposition against this date, Ricardo, you had your hand raised?
Yeah. Thanks, Thomas. Just a friendly request, perhaps. Wouldn't it be possible to have this the next call scheduled a tiny bit earlier for the people here in Europe? Thanks.
Let's hear David first, and then I hand over to Barry to respond to that. David, please.
There's a problem that the registry stakeholder group has a regular meeting for example, today the registry representatives are missing the long-term schedule of the registry stakeholder group. So I would personally support retaining the hour of 1900 UTC.
Okay.
Thomas, it's Jim Bykoff. I have the same problem as David with another organization, earlier phone call.
Okay, so Ricardo, I'm afraid we're stuck with that. You know, because I would really like to see representation or more representation of the registry stakeholder group and Jim. So even if it's inconvenient, I apologize for that, but I'm afraid that we don't have. Oh, I'm just seeing it's 4 a.m. in Melbourne. I sympathize with that. Barry, do you know whether there are any viable alternatives to that time of the day that would be more suitable for everybody?
Thomas, this is Barry. If you'd like, or if the working group wishes, we can send out a doodle poll and have members kind of complete their preferred times and see if there's any room to adjust by an hour or two or something along those lines.
Okay. Nonetheless, for next week, I would propose we stick to the time given so that people can put that into their calendars, and it would be great if you could send out that doodle poll in the coming days. So we might be able to make adjustments for the week after next week. Ricardo, your hand is raised again.
Yeah, sorry for insisting. I think a doodle is a really easy thing to do. I mean, Barry could, if I may request that they could send this still today or like tomorrow morning, and we could quickly answer to in terms of availability of times. Because then we can clearly see, I mean, if we are to ensure representation by all people concerned, we have a non-negligible number of people who are residing in Europe, and it's not really easy for us to participate in a call from 8 or 9 o'clock. So just to whether we may find some better common ground would be great. That's really something that can be quickly answered by all concerned. And then if, of course, there is no one else able to participate in another time, then, of course, I rest my case. But just to be sure about that. Thanks.
Okay, Ricardo, let's keep the time for the moment. Should the doodle poll come to the result that we can change time quickly, you will get another notification on that. I have Alan, and that's going to be the last statement during this call. Alan, please.
Just a short one. No matter what time we pick, it's going to be bad for somebody. That's a given, or probably more than somebody. And, yes, we can do a doodle quickly, but it's going to take several days, and by the time a decision is made, that would mean we are changing the time of this meeting on 2 or 3 days' notice, and that always has significant problems in terms of attendance. So I would strongly recommend we not try to change it for next week. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. This meeting is coming to a close very shortly. Just in terms of my hope for the next meeting, that is that I hope that we have all the information at our fingertips before the next meeting takes place. Should Chuck and the others be available to update us on the previous work, you know, guide us through the history of reserved names and related aspects, we should take this hurdle, quote unquote, or answer the question during next meeting, during the next meeting, or shortly thereafter, in order to be able to address the other areas afterwards. I would very much like staff in the first place for making it possible, despite the policy staff retreat, to participate in this call and to prepare for it. Thanks so much, and I'd like to thank you all for a very vivid and helpful discussion, and I hope that we're going to be able to make good progress in the next coming weeks. Thank you so much, and bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.